From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Broilers, fryers, roasters, turkeys, chickens, eggs, these are all the products of the poultry industry in North Carolina. The Poultry Federation claims it contributes more than $34 billion to North Carolina's economy. Statistics from the North Carolina Poultry Jubilee are a bit more moderate. They claim an economic impact to the state of $12.8 billion. They don't disagree so much, however, on the number of jobs this business creates. Between 109 and 110,000 people make their living bringing birds and eggs to the table. This edition of Coastline is the final installment in our series on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Over the previous 4 weeks, we've focused on specific elements of hog farming. Today, we shift the focus to poultry CAFOs. These farming operations are also a source of concern for environmental advocates. Today, we'll learn more about how large poultry operations function from two contract growers, one current and one former, and we'll hear why environmentalists worry the growth of this industry degrades local water quality. With us today is the former vice president of live production for both Purdue Farms and Butterball, one of the largest poultry producers in the United States. David Anderson is also a past president of the Poultry Federation. David Anderson, welcome to Coastline.
Good morning, Rachel. Thank you.
Craig Watts is a former poultry farmer who once contracted with Purdue Farms. He had a highly publicized disagreement with Purdue over his decision to let an animal advocacy group take pictures inside his farming operation. He has since ended his relationship with Purdue. Craig Watts, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And joining us today also is a current poultry farmer who is a contractor with Purdue, John Carter Jr. Welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about how poultry CAFOs operate in North Carolina? Do you work in the poultry industry? Email your question or comment to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us today at @CoastlineHQR. And a bit later in the program, we'll take your phone calls. John Carter, a Purdue chicken's life spans about 35 days from beginning to end. So can you give us a guided tour as a current contract grower for Purdue from the day the chick hatches, day one, to the day that chick arrives on your farm, and what happens then?
Well, I'll try to do that, Rachel. We receive the birds as they have fresh hatched right from the hatchery, and we make sure as they arrive that that the temperature is warm. It's approximately around 88 to 90 degrees.
Inside the birdhouse.
Inside the birdhouse, in the middle of the birdhouse. The birds were concerned that they rapidly learn where the water is and the feed is there. It's all put out ahead of time. The shavings, the litter, it's all warm, and it's a very comfortable environment. Then we'll give the baby chicks for about 8 to 10 days. We'll have feed in many different locations so that they have easy access to feed. We're watching the birds to see how comfortable they are, how the environmental conditions are, the air coming in, preheated air, that they are very, very comfortable. And from that point, we're looking for anything that's, significant changes, birds that are areas that might be cold, areas that are too warm, and we adjust. We have computer controls that that monitor the temperature in the houses. And then from there, once the birds start, if they start well, then everything goes pretty steady. We monitor throughout the day the condition of the birds by stepping in, by walking around the birds, stirring the birds up, making sure that the water and the feed are available to the birds throughout their life. Now, our birds, we grow to about 35, 36 days because we grow smaller birds for specific restaurant trades. Birds can also grow to 60-plus days, and they're the heavier birds that would be 8.5 to 9 pounds.
And so those are the birds that people would find in the grocery store, those heavier birds.
Yes, that is correct.
And how many birds does your farm house on a regular basis?
We've got quite large houses. We have about 28,000 to 29,000 birds at any one time. And They have they're able to range back and forth from one end of the house to the other end of the house. It's always interesting to see one odd color, because they're mostly white. But if you see a little black bird or a little brown bird, and watch them move around in the house, because they will go from one corner, one end to the other, and particularly as they're younger, and even as they get older, you just watch and you're just like, I didn't know they moved around that much. But they are quite interesting to watch.
And Craig Watts, you no longer contract with Purdue, but you were once a poultry farmer with Purdue.
Yeah, for 23 and a half years.
And was it a different kind of chicken that you raised?
No, he and I were doing the same thing. When I ended, we were running a bird about 35, 36 days, maybe 4 1/4, 4.5 pounds. So he and I are in the same complex.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your story actually went national. It made national news. You let a camera crew into your facilities. Can you tell us what they filmed and what became so controversial?
Well, it really goes back further before I ever invited the camera crew in. We were having a lot of issues when they took the antibiotics out of the hatcheries. And I was seeing enophilitis, which is bacteria-laden chicks when they get to the farm, and it was just time and time and time again. And we were having some other problems, so I was snapping pictures, and I was sending videos to the grow-out office at the time. There was never an issue with it. Then I got a delivery one time, and what happened was the dumping crew just sat there, and they dumped them right on top of one another. They have little boxes, you know, they're about 100 chicks, and they must have dumped, you know, 10 boxes on one on top of another. So went back in there a couple hours later, I had a bunch of dead bitties. And so I just happened to have my phone in my pocket, and I was walking around, and I was filming and commentating. And so I sent it to I was going to send it to the grow-out manager, but it was too big of a file. I uploaded it on YouTube. I sent it as a private link, and oh, my goodness, they were down there in about – well, they wanted to come that right then, but I waited till the next day. But they never really did do anything, and I saw a lot of things that I thought advertising, that the marketing was not exactly what the public was getting. The one thing that sticks out the most was there's a commercial with Jim Purdue, and he's driving down the road, and he's talking about how they're transparent. And I can tell you right where I was sitting when I saw that commercial. I was in Brookings, South Dakota in June of 2012. And it was like one of those moments like when Elvis died, you knew kind of where you were. And so I was like, transparent, okay. But then he stops and he goes into a poultry house. And there's market-age birds. The shavings are brand new pine shavings, just put in there. Anyway, it was all staged. Brand new spotless equipment, perfect pellets. The birds have like a half an acre a piece to roam around in. So I'm sitting there thinking, that's not what it looks like. And at the time I was working with a reporter, I was advocating for farmer contracts, and this kind of morphed, you know, out of that. He asked me, would I like to meet a friend of his who was a chicken expert, meaning behavioral expert? And I said, well, yeah. And it was the lady from Compassion Award Farming.
Which is an animal advocacy organization.
Right. And they have she is on a board of animal welfare, which that was kind of the argument. And really, I didn't do it for animal welfare. It was the mislabeling of the product. That's what I was after. The USDA was certifying things that I didn't think were right. But anyway, so they came down and they filmed, and you know, to say it changed my life is the understatement of a lifetime. 24 hours later, there's like a 500,000 YouTube views. There's like over 2.5 million now. But you know,
well, that one of those precipitating events that you described, when the delivery came and they dumped the chicks on top of one another, and then you had a lot of dead chicks.
Right.
Was that a one-time thing, or is that something that happened on a regular basis?
Well, that particular thing is I would say that was very rare.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, it was going to cost me.
So your real issue with Purdue at the time was how they were advertising their products.
Right. Image versus reality.
Right.
Yeah.
And David Anderson, how did Purdue respond to the pictures that emerged from Craig Watts' facility?
I wasn't really at Purdue at that time, so I can't speak very specifically. I would guess that there was an investigation into that hatchery and the hatchery practices, and a confirmation that all the practices that were in place were done accurately and done in a humane manner.
John Carter, as someone who takes day-old chicks into your farm, Was that sort of a difficult transition for poultry farmers to go from having antibiotics in the feed to having no antibiotics and then dealing with more bacterial infections? Is that?
Well, I would say this. There was a learning curve to it, yes. We all had to learn together. I think that with Purdue being an industry leader in going away from antibiotics, and that's where we're at today, I think that each flock, something changed. So yes, they were adapting to it. It's nobody had done that before. And particularly with the high health birds that we have and the birds that are, you know, we protect the biosecurity because we don't want any disease coming in. And so, yes, we did learn. And I think we adapted quite quickly to it. And our birds today, I don't think you would know anything different, just the way we handle them. And so for us, it has worked very well.
Craig Watts.
I totally agree. We had issues when they removed the antibiotics from the hatchery, meaning that hatchery is not a sterile place. So it really showed the gap between what the antibiotics were taking care of in the hatchery, because it is it's an entry point for bacteria, and we were seeing it with the little chicks. Now, what he's talking about when they started taking antibiotics out of feed, man, we rolled. I mean, I really same weight gains. I didn't have any issues as far as, you know, once the birds got on the farm. It was what was happening before they were getting to the farm. That was where the issue was.
But there were some other pictures that came out of your farm that really disturbed animal advocates. And can you describe some of what people saw, the chickens with?
Well, I mean, you know, when you get
And that's our music going to break, and we'll let you finish that thought when we come back in about 90 seconds. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about poultry farms in North Carolina, the very different experiences of two Purdue contract farmers, one current, one former. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about poultry farming in North Carolina, specifically on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, contracting with Purdue Farms, one of the largest poultry producers in the U.S. With us to answer your questions about the industry are David Anderson, former vice president of Purdue's and Butterball's live production operations and past president of the Poultry Federation. We also have John Carter, a current contract farmer with Purdue, and Craig Watts, a former Purdue contract farmer who's now critical of industry practices. The phones are now open if you have a question for any of our guests. The phone number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Craig Watts, right before we went to break, you were about to describe what some of the pictures were that made national news after people came into your facilities and you actually posted pictures yourself of what was happening inside your facilities. What was so upsetting?
Well, the issue was up to that point, there was really very little transparency. You know, there was undercover videos, which I'm not a fan of because they're staged, or some of them are, none of them are. But I just figured I would open the doors and I'd walk and talk. And what you saw was, you know, you have some little issues with chicks. You'll have some with no eyes and no beaks, and you have issues with young breeder flocks. You have issues with old breeder flocks. You have issues with sanitation of the hatchery. You have issues with the time the eggs are hatched, the time they get to your farm. Just a lot of stuff. So you'll see a myriad of problems in the beginning. Not all the time. Now, if you don't, you're good to go. But you don't ever know till they get there, okay? And then at the end, you'll start seeing some leg problems, and you'll really see just generally how they're so chest heavy that it's doing one step, two steps, three steps, sit down. And that's really what they're bred to do. And I think people just didn't know. And they're like, and then plus the density that they're sort of packed tight in there, and that you're raising the birds on last flock's litter or poop in this flocks too, and they just you reuse it and reuse it, so it's bacteria laden. That's where the drugs in the feed come in. And no, there's not antibiotics anymore, but there's still drugs in it.
Speaking of antibiotics and the presence or absence of those, David Anderson, formerly of Purdue and Butterball and the Poultry Federation, can you tell us what the standards are now with antibiotics in the industry?
Yeah, the standards are that if you produce and sell meat that is that meets the antibiotic-free criteria, then that bird or that animal can never be administered any antibiotic at all, either in the hatchery or in the water or in the feed. It can't have antibiotics at any point in its lifetime.
And how is something, does Purdue produce anything that is antibiotic free?
Yes, absolutely.
And how is that labeled? That doesn't, that's not the all natural label, is it? That's, it has to say antibiotic free.
Having been away from Purdue 10 years and this being such a ticklish subject, the antibiotic free versus naturally raised and so forth, I'm not qualified to speak on the Purdue criteria, marketing criteria, but if it is, if it meets the USDA antibiotic free label, it can never have an antibiotic during its lifetime.
And John Carter, does your facility use antibiotics? Is that part of the feed, or can you sort of describe what chickens are eating when they're inside your birdhouses?
As far as our birds, I can't remember the last time we had anything that was an antibiotic. The only time we would ever do it is if the birds, if it was life-threatening to the birds, and it was going to be just a catastrophic type of illness. But it's been a number of years since we've used anything that would be an antibiotic. Yes, that is correct.
And Craig Watts, you described new birds coming into the litter from birds that have since left your facilities. Why is it? Why is it so difficult, or why was it so difficult for you to sort of stay on top of cleaning out the litter and culling the birds? Can you?
Well, I mean, there was no issue with culling the birds. You cull every day. You're looking at 120,000 chickens. You're not going to get every coil out of there every day, which I thought that accusation was absurd. And it's standard industry practice to reuse that litter for a year, or now most of us are going to Winroad, or I used to. I don't know if you've gone to it or not. And you reuse that litter over and over and over again. So to say that you're supposed to clean it out every flock or top dress it every flock, some may, some not. But it's very standard to use that litter at least a year.
And once you, and by the way, for folks who aren't familiar with some of the jargon in the industry, what does cull mean in a birdhouse?
If a bird is not healthy, if you can tell that he's not going to develop in the way he should, then you take it, you kill it. And there's a accepted method the way you do it, and it's just out of respect for the animal, because he's going to suffer if you don't.
And how many birds were you dealing with at a time?
Total or culls?
At a time, and then how many calls did you have to deal with?
Oh, gosh, the calls vary. Sometimes it's awful. Sometimes you cruise right through with very few. But the total, about 120,000 at the time on my farm at four houses at 30,000 a house, give or take.
David Anderson, can you talk a little bit about the growth of the poultry industry in North Carolina and when it really started to become such an important part of North Carolina's agricultural engine?
Well, it's been an important part of North Carolina ag during my lifetime, and a significant part of the North Carolina economy, and certainly a big part, if not the largest part, of the North Carolina ag economy. And North Carolina perpetuates that growth because of our location. We're close to the Northeast, which is a big customer market. We're close to the grain belt, so we can secure the feedstuffs to feed the animals. And then the people that we have in North Carolina have the honesty and the integrity to build good birds and build a good business. So North Carolina works real well from a grower and a producer perspective from that.
But some of the more highly publicized issues with the poultry industry around the country have to do with some of the birds that Craig Watts described, birds that have very large breasts and don't have legs that are strong enough to carry them for more than a few steps, if they can walk at all. Is there any concern within the industry about the kinds of birds that are being bred and whether this is humane. And we know some companies are going to slower growing kinds of chickens, smaller chickens.
There absolutely is that concern. And our customers continually now, even more so than in years past, they ask us, how are the birds being cared for? How is your animal welfare program? And so we, and every company has implemented their own animal welfare program where they go around and they audit facilities and they train people how to handle birds. But in the genetics, we do breed birds to grow faster and to grow more efficiently and more a better feed conversion. And that does, if you go to an extreme, that can lead to a health issue. And so as we develop our animal welfare program, we got to make sure that we use that animal welfare program in our genetics program and we don't breed to any extreme that exacerbates any problem the bird may have in handling that meat and that production.
Craig Watts, as a former contract grower for Purdue, what are some of the changes that you would like to see made in the industry, in the practices?
I don't want to come here and just knock on Purdue. I just happen to be a Purdue producer. I mean, there's industry-wide issues. But from what my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, John, they're actually going leaps and bounds now. They're putting the windows back in the houses. They're talking about putting perches back in the houses, outdoor access, a lot of the stuff that we talked about in that video. And if they don't want to admit that that had something to do with it, that's fine as long as the end result gets done. And so I think he's right. They were the leader in the antibiotic-free deal, and they're going to probably be the leader in the better animal welfare from what I'm hearing from farmers. Is that what you're
– Yeah, I think –
John
if
Carter,
I may,
yes.
I think the things that are coming are definitely things that have been learned in studies of animal welfare and animal behavior. And the industry has changed substantially since I got out of college in the 70s. And I think it's all for the good. But as we learn, we apply things. And it is best for all of us for these practices to be in place, growing the chickens, and as far as the long-term health of the animals, and also the safety, the food safety, and the products that we do, and so that is our focus. I think we do an exceptional job at our farm. My 26-year-old daughter is running the farm. She's got a degree from Appalachian State, and she's very in tune with what's going on. And it brings a different aspect to it. A young lady that is very in tune with the environment around her, and I think she does an exceptional job. And we're a family farm.
So what are some of these new trends then? David Anderson, you mentioned the animal welfare program. What components make up that animal welfare program, and what are some of the things that your daughter, John Carter, has brought to your attention and said, hey, Dad, we need to think about doing this? So David Anderson, we'll go to you first.
Well, you got to make sure that the equipment in the house is adequate to feed the birds and water the birds and ventilate the birds at a comfortable and prosperous level. And so a lot of it has to do with equipment. Just does a house have the proper equipment to take good care of the birds? And then it gets into practices. And you can have a very well, and most companies do have a very well-defined program on temperature and feeder and water management for birds at different ages. And there's all kinds of specifics there. Certainly, there are standards in terms of litter care to make sure that if litter gets wet for some reason, that it's removed or replaced. And there's many different standards that you apply on a farm, and you just got to make sure companies do to make sure that the grower knows those standards and understand those standards, and then the company has to visit periodically to make sure those standards are being upheld.
John Carter, what are some of the issues that your daughter might have brought to your attention?
She's constantly in and out, in particular, making the adjustments off of the standard temperatures to see if the birds are comfortable. She'll adjust the temperature 1 degree or another to make sure that, and she can do that because she understands the birds. When it comes to things that I think that we've changed over the last 2 years is we've changed the type of light that we've got to a more natural light inside. Now, they are in the midst of studying. Craig had mentioned the adding sunlight and windows.
And I think as that becomes more understood as far as how the animals behave and handle that, we'll see, we'll probably see more of that. And so I think just being able to adapt and looking at those things that make the birds more comfortable and grow better is good for everybody.
And to be fair, it seems to a layperson, I probably shouldn't use that term in this context, but to someone who's not an expert, as a chicken farmer or a turkey farmer, sunshine for birds seems like a no-brainer. But that's something that the poultry industry is now measuring in a more quantitative sense.
Yeah, versus the light that we have inside, just the light that we produce, even now it's a brighter, more it's closer to natural sunlight as well. And we've seen that I think that has helped as well to do that. So the next step is looking at how much difference does it make to add real sunlight to the birds? Do they respond to that? And I think those questions will be answered over the next few years.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the multi-billion-dollar poultry industry in North Carolina. With us today to answer your questions are David Anderson. He's former vice president of live operations for Perdue and Butterball. He's also a past president of the Poultry Federation. We have John Carter, current contract farmer with Perdue, and Craig Watts, a former contract farmer with Perdue. If you have a question for any of our guests, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. David Anderson, there was a response from the industry from Craig Watts' video that was posted that did make national news. An executive spoke about more efforts down the road to shine a public light on the chicken farming process, perhaps even putting cameras in houses. Is that something that you've heard more discussion about recently? Is that something some of these big poultry producers might actually do in the name of transparency?
There is some ongoing discussion of just that, because we want people to feel comfortable with the conditions their bird and their food are being produced under, because it is a foodstuff that we're selling as a bottom line. However, there are also some trade secrets that different companies exercise, that they're, this is a competitive world and trying to produce a cheap meat. And so there are some concerns there, but that is an ongoing discussion.
And other people have said that this is the price we pay for cheap meat, is that some of the animals perhaps don't have the most humane conditions. And there has been this national movement towards, farm to table, local food, the explosion of the business of Whole Foods and organizations like that. So is there ever any discussion among the biggest producers of maybe we raise our prices and build that cost into the price of the bird, since people seem to want to pay more?
Well, in terms of that mindset of humane production versus cost, the bottom line is that always kind of stupefies me, because a bird, we're in the business of producing that meat as cheaply as possible. And the way the bird does that is by performance, by feed conversion, by livability. And feed conversion and livability is driven by humane conditions. So if you take care of your birds so that any customer would look at that and say, that bird's well taken care of, that bird also will perform. And that's what our objective, any objective of a company is also concurrent with. So it's kind of interesting, that whole dialogue sometimes.
Craig Watts, we have just a few minutes left in this segment. So if you could leave folks, if you could dispel a myth around the industry or around some of the practices or highlight an issue that you would really like to see improved, what would that be? What do you think needs to change in the poultry industry?
Oh, my. One thing? Well, at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, we all work for the consumer. I think we need to be honest with that consumer. And if we're going to put something on a label, by God, you better be able to objectively verify it. you know, not puffery, not nuances, you know, not meaningless terms.
What are some of the things on labels that you think consumers should be cautious about or maybe a little skeptical of?
Well, I mean, one was humanely raised, but the courts actually made them take that off the label. Says who? There's no standard there. It was just on a label. And the other one was, they put cage-free on it. Well, there's no broiler in the United States of America raised in a cage for meat. It just doesn't happen that way. It's like saying the sky is blue. All natural, I mean, what does that mean? Really? I mean, you feed a bird synthetic drugs and you call it all natural. But all natural actually means minimally processed. So maybe it should say that. But just the consumers educating themselves to know, you know, are they getting a better product? Because you got to be scared of organic, cage-free, all that kind of stuff. I mean, all that kind of, not cage-free.
What does organic mean?
It depends. For a chicken. Well, you know, you've got organic, like the people raising them out in pastures, and they also have confined organic. Purdue bought Coleman Natural Farms, and I'm pretty sure they have an organic line now. And then you've got the guy, you know, out in the Midwest that's, you know, just raised them in his backyard. They're both organic, but quite a different, you know, beast.
Do you see yourself getting back into poultry farming?
No, ma'am. Just 23 years, and it's time to move on. We're going to actually convert the houses to, right now we're looking at hydroponics. It may not be that, but something.
Uh-huh. You're converting your former birdhouses.
Yes.
To growing plants.
Right.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about contract farming in the poultry industry in North Carolina. That includes chickens, turkeys, eggs. Craig Watts, thank you so much for joining us today. When we come back after this 90-second break, we'll find out why the Cape Fear River Keeper is concerned about impacts on water quality. You can ask your question or tell us about your experience with a North Carolina poultry operation by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about the poultry industry in North Carolina, a multi-billion dollar component of the state's agricultural economy. And with us today is David Anderson, past vice president of Purdue's and Butterball's live operations. He's also a past president of the Poultry Federation. We also have current Purdue contract farmer John Carter with us. And joining us now is the Cape Fear River Keeper, Kemp Burdett. Welcome, Kemp.
Thank you, Rachel.
If you have a question about the industry, you can give us a call today at 910-343-1138 or share your experience with us. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Kemp Burdett, Cape Fear River Keeper, we invited you on the program because you have made some observations about the way some of the poultry waste is handled from some of the concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Can you tell us what your concerns are?
Sure. You know, in a nutshell, my concern is that we have in North Carolina so many CAFOs, both swine and poultry, and of course recently a rapidly increasing poultry industry, that the landscape and the environment couldn't possibly absorb the impacts. So in North Carolina in the last roughly 20 years, we've seen a 21% increase in the number of chickens in the state. We've seen about a 22% decrease in the number of farms or CAFOs. So we're seeing even more concentration of even more birds. So that's concentrating waste, which is very problematic for the Cape Fear River and other waterways. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, most people know about the problems of the swine industry, but now we're seeing the poultry industry compounding those problems by just increasing the amount of industrial animal waste that we have in the landscape.
John Carter, current contract farmer with Purdue, how is animal waste handled on your farm? What's the process?
Well, it's totally different than the hog industry. First, because it's a dry product. And we what we do is we work through a litter broker. We have a nutrient management plan, but we also work through a litter broker that keeps all the records. He goes, and it's a very natural product to use, and many of the farmers use it to land apply before their crops go on, and they do it.
Farmers who are growing crops buy this to fertilize their crops.
Yes, they use agronomic levels, and they, you know, they have to monitor that. From our standpoint, we have a beautiful farm. I'm a city boy. I'm not a farm boy. I grew up in the city, and so we're very interested in making sure that what we have is well cared for. We're concerned about the environment. And that how we handle things and how we do things, I think, is in a very professional manner. And we're proud of what we do. And so that's how we handle it. We do things right.
So Kemp Burdett, Cape Fear Riverkeeper, the way John Carter is describing this dry litter that then gets sold to a farmer who's going to use it as fertilizer, what's the problem with that?
Well, I don't think it matters if we're talking about litter or bananas. You can have too much of anything in an environment. And so in North Carolina, we're seeing that an average broiler produces about a quarter pound of waste. We're seeing that,
Do you mean on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, correct. We're seeing that, these barns have anywhere from 22 to, as John mentioned earlier, 28,000-29,000 birds. So if you start doing conservative calculations there based on five flocks per year, you're seeing about, just in the Cape Fear River Basin, there are about 5,000 chicken barns. In the state of North Carolina, there's about 14,400 chicken barns. So if you add all that up, you get about 8.2 billion pounds annually in the Cape Fear River Basin, and about 23.5 billion pounds annually of poultry waste in the state of North Carolina or in the Cape Fear River Basin, respectively. That is a number that is so big it's almost incomprehensible. It doesn't matter what it is. The fact that it's waste that has high levels of nutrients, has high levels of bacteria, is very problematic. And we're just talking about poultry right now. We're not even considering the fact that this is stacked up on top of already existing problems related to swine spray fields.
John Carter.
If I may add to that, one of the things that you have to consider, the farmers, the row crop farmers, are going to apply some nutrients to their fields. They have to grow corn and other products. What they're doing is they're substituting the more natural litter and waste for petroleum-based chemicals that would grow the crops. And so it's a more natural process. So if you remove one, it makes more room for the other. And so that's where the more natural the litter that we're producing has the opportunity to go in there, because it eliminates the need for the petroleum-based products as well.
David Anderson.
And in terms of the supply, to answer another question that was put on the table, the industry is every year challenged to produce more of this fertilizer for crop production. And so
you're saying there's a greater demand for this fertilizer?
Absolutely. It is a valuable fertilizer, and our growers, our farmers who grow birds, in disposing of the fertilizer, they can get through a broker, a litter broker, they can get compensated very well because the value is high as a fertilizer.
Kemp Burdett, you've done some flyovers of poultry farms. What have you found?
We frequently find litter stored in a matter that is illegal based on the laws that govern litter storage in North Carolina. We've reported in the last 2 years in North Carolina 65 instances of litter piles being left exposed longer than 15 days uncovered.
Is that one of the regulations that it can sit there, a pile of litter can sit there for 15 days and then something has to be done with it?
Right. It either has to be spread or it has to be covered. It can't be placed next to waterways. We find frequent violations of this, and we report those violations frequently in a very detailed and legal referral.
And to whom do you report this?
In my case, to the Wilmington Office of Department of Environmental Quality. And at that point, we are unable to determine what happens next because of the way North Carolina agriculture, the laws that manage agriculture and the laws that manage what DEQ can discuss after we've made that referral, which is another piece of the problem here. This industry is anything but transparent. We don't learn anything about that referral unless a notice of violation is issued, and notices of violation are exceedingly rare for DEQ to issue to CAFOs of any sort in North Carolina based on the political power that CAFOs have here.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about poultry CAFOs in North Carolina. And we have Larry from New Bern. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it. Just wanted to touch on the transparency issue a little bit. I've had the pleasure of working with Kemp for a number of years, probably more than maybe Kemp wants to admit sometimes. But one of the biggest concerns and problems we have with, particularly with the poultry industry, is this issue of transparency. And, you know, Kemp mentioned the fact that we can make these referrals on how the waste is being disposed of, and we cannot really find out anything further once we make those referrals, unless it goes further. The industry as a whole is very much clouded in secrecy, and even from a legislative standpoint, you have the North Carolina General Statute. It's 106-24.1, which basically says the Department of Agriculture doesn't have to share any information with the public about this industry. And Kemp mentioned the flyovers that we do quite frequently and places that we see this waste that's being stored. That's really the only hook, so to speak, that we have to try to hold an industry accountable for what they're doing to the environment.
So why isn't, if you think that there are violations and you're documenting these and you're passing them on to the Department of Environmental Quality, isn't it DEQ's responsibility to hold the industry's feet to the fire, not yours?
Well, I think that's, again, where the problem comes in, is that you have a state, and I'm sorry to put it this way, but a state government that is very much industry-friendly and is not looking at the overall impacts, not just to the environment, but also to the communities. And this is the kind of thing that Kemp is dealing with on a daily basis. And, you know, without the proper transparency, seems to be the word that we're using today, you know, the work that Kemp is doing is still kind of clouded in secrecy from the standpoint of once he sees a violation, if the state doesn't react to it, then Kemp knows no more than what he did before he started. This is really, it's really not a fair practice when you have people like Kemp and other river keepers in North Carolina who are trying to protect the environment. We're not trying to put anybody out of business. We're just trying to put them out of pollution business.
Larry, thank you so much for your call. David Anderson, the Poultry Federation, I'd like you to respond to Larry's concerns here in Kemp's.
Well, when river keepers or any other entity reports a violation, then DEQ does respond. They investigate. And if they find an issue, if they clarify that there is an issue, then they definitely respond to the farmer and to the company involved. That happens very infrequently because they don't find the issues. They don't document the issues. And they don't come to us with an issue. It has happened, but it is infrequent. But believe me, DEQ does respond, and there is a transparency because a company with a customer wants to be 100% transparent and show them that they're doing the right thing. And in today's world, you have to be able to prove that to a customer. And so that transparency does happen.
Kemp Burdett, how do you know during these flyovers, for instance, that you're looking at the same pile of litter that you were looking at 17 days ago?
We take high-resolution photographs, and we document the exact location with GPS, and we complete detailed field logs that document everything we're seeing, where the piles are located. Any information about the piles. And we frequently see these things. We do a lot of trips around CAFO country, and you know, we see the same piles day after day. It's just when they hit that 15-day window that we report them. So, you know, this is a very common practice. And to touch again on the transparency piece, you know, I don't think anybody in North Carolina who pays attention to The way DEQ does business these days would say that Department of Environmental Quality is a department of state government that has environmental protection as its primary goal. I think very much they are a customer service, department. The leadership of DEQ has, completely switched the department's mission, and it is a very sympathetic department to industry in North Carolina now. And I think that's very problematic, and I think we're seeing the impacts of that on the environment in many different sectors of industry across North Carolina.
And you talk about more nutrients being in the water and entering the Cape Fear River. Does that impact this part of the coastal areas in North Carolina? Are you seeing any kind of quantifiable impact?
Most definitely. We're seeing, and it impacts it in a very important way, which it impacts our drinking water supplies. New Hanover County, Brunswick County, and parts of Pender County get their drinking water above Lock and Dam number one. At King's Bluff, we've seen in the last 10 or 12 years increasing occurrences of blue-green algal blooms like Microcystis that thrives on the nutrients produced and discharged by CAFOs. When waters warm up and slow down and you have a steady supply of nutrients, you see algal blooms like the one you saw in Toledo, where 500,000 people lost their drinking water supply because of the toxins associated with blue-green algal blooms like cyanobacteria.
We have an email from Christine who writes, there was a USGS study that was completed last year showing the impacts of waste on our public waters. The current waste management methodology is not protecting our public waterways. Why is this methodology still in practice and poultry waste still polluting our water? John Carter, clearly there are a lot of people who are concerned about the impacts of this dry litter and where it actually travels. Is this something that's ever discussed on your farm? Are there discussions in the industry about addressing waste management practices?
We clearly understand what the requirements are for us. We have ours is always under shelter, and it's either in the house or it's in a litter shed. And we've done that. We've been raising chickens for 11 years, and in both, we do it right. And so, we follow the regulations. We redid our nutrient management plan a couple of years ago because we added four more houses. And so, and it is the individual's responsibility. It's not the production company's. Now, the production company influences that as far as they don't want bad actors either. Purdue doesn't want bad actors.
Right.
But it's
you're
my
audited.
Response. Yes.
You're audited by Purdue. They'll show up. Inspectors will show up on your farm from time to time.
And I think the large majority of the industry are good actors. They do it right. And that's where we're at. So we haven't had any run-ins with any environmental groups.
Kemp Burdett, do you think that there are new laws or new regulations that need to be in place, does there just need to be better enforcement of the existing regulations?
I think both. I think, and when I say new laws, I really mean more of a complete change in the industry. We have to treat animal waste. We can't just spread it out on fields in the amounts that we're spreading it on now and not expect to see continued degradation of our waterways, our drinking water supplies, our fisheries, our human health. We haven't talked about on this segment about the impacts of these farms to the people that live around these farms. And if we don't start treating waste, we are going to see disasters like we saw associated with the hog industry in the 90s.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank Craig Watts, David Anderson, Kemp Burdett, and John Carter for joining us today. Remember, you can now hear Coastline twice a week on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Next week, we talk with local garden expert Tom Erickson of The Transplanted Garden, Wednesday, June 1st. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.